The next and last speaker of the day is Michael Grubb from University College London. And he will talk about the limits to standard policy. Michael.
Very much indeed. I'll actually start by saying that perhaps until Dallas spoke, as Michael Hanneman said, there might have been a lot of different views, but there seemed consensus that the situation was deeply depressing and not very hopeful. My background, I should stress, is primarily empirical energy economics. I've done some modelling. I don't have time to cover that, though it's linked to some of the conceptual points I want to make. But Dallas was a little bit more upbeat, and I thought I'd try and continue that trend, if only in the following way, to observe that, well, of course the global statistics are deeply depressing. Just look at China. If you ask the same data question about the regions that, in effect, way back in the mid-90s, early 90s, agreed that they should start trying to tackle this problem and have tried various things, I'm kind of curious how many people know what US per capita emissions are today, or as of last year, compared with 15 years earlier. Anyone want to put a hand up? Towards the end of the day, I thought I'd slightly waken people up. Huh? US emissions are 17% below what they were 15 years earlier, whilst US GDP has increased 16%. That 17%, incidentally, is true whether you look at that on US territorial emissions or the US emissions footprint. That's an absolute reduction. I'm not talking about relative to GDP, so it's over 30% gain relative to GDP. Same stats in the European Union, for the West European 15. European Union territorial emissions are down 21% compared with 15 years ago. Consumption, not so good, because we've outsourced more. It's down about 14%. On the best data available, whilst GDP per capita, again, has grown 12.5%. So at least we are well out of the world in which emissions seem to keep rising with GDP. We actually left that world more than two decades ago in the rich countries. Now, anyone concerned with high level of ambition, climate change, well, yeah, but that's not enough, and it's not much of the world's population. But part of my theme here is, yeah, it's actually really quite important because the dynamics of this issue are dynamic and they are largely to do also with the development and the spread of both technologies and policies and the learning thereof. And effectively, I just want to argue that there are some serious seeds of hope. Ironically, if you put together the two main intellectual strands of today, namely pricing and technology, but that neither on its own is remotely adequate. So Roger actually offered me the title, I think, of The Limits to Standard Policy. I thought I'd make that a little bit more positive and talk about beyond standard policy. And I'm going to run you through a few key sections there. And I stress I mostly want to get at the conceptual issues and assumptions around the relationship of price and innovation. Now, I wasn't sure what Roger really meant by standard policy, but I kind of assumed that it meant carbon pricing. And so I thought I would start with the really pessimistic side of carbon pricing. I have been in this field a long time. I spent quite a lot of the 1990s advocating carbon pricing. It is 25 years since the European Commission put down a formal legal proposal for a European carbon tax. Worked very hard to push it. It then got made conditional upon this, upon that, and eventually, finally, was abandoned in 1998. After almost 10 years, you could argue really trying to do the right thing, well done, or banging its head against a brick wall before it went down another avenue. 5 years ago, obviously, we've heard Dallas talking briefly about the neatness, apparently, of a national cap and trade and what happened with that, and how that has gradually been replaced by a more complex strata of policy. But in relation to some of the comments this morning about carbon pricing, I did want to stress this is not new. This is a very old debate. It has been tried really hard. Huge amounts of political capital have been expended on carbon pricing. One social scientist observed, it's funny that the most recommended instrument by analysts appeared to be the most problematic politically. That's a rendition of that quote. And Stéphane Dion, who stood for the Canadian election, partly on the platform of a tax shift from bads to goods, ultimately summarised that much more succinctly as a politician might: carbon pricing is political suicide. Now, that does not mean I think we should abandon the effort. It means I think we have to think afresh about the policy and the political narrative and the wider developments around this instrument if we are to see any of the kinds of gains that a lot of people today have advocated. The central challenge, in my view, here is a divergence between the representative economic agent view of the world versus democracy populated by real people. That is the fundamental political economy challenge, or overall policy challenge. We all know what the rational economic agent in a well-functioning market that trusts its government, et cetera, should conclude about carbon. For most voters, emission reductions is a recognisable public good. That's why they support emission reduction targets. Taxation is a pressing private bad, and they are most unlikely to support it and vote for it unless they actually trust an awful lot of things. I put a side comment in there about Vikings and virtues. It refers to a paper that came out in the journal I edit, Climate Policy, with that title. It's more than 10 years old. The paper itself, and the paper itself was called Lessons from 10 Years of Carbon Pricing in Scandinavia, because the four Scandinavian countries have had carbon taxes for 25 years. And the conclusion of this article was, yeah, it's basically because they trust their governments to do sensible things with the revenue, and they trust their governments when the governments say, this is going to hurt at first, but it will be good for you. And eventually that has enabled some of those countries to actually substantially increase the level of carbon taxation. The European Union did not have the same level of trust. They seized a political opportunity to go down the cap and trade route. In my view, it is not at all clear that the fundamental trust is increased by increasing the political scale up to the international or global level and saying, this tax is all right because it's been negotiated by the United Nations. I don't see that going down terribly well with US voters or Congress or indeed most other jurisdictions. I think to try and get at a carbon price and a more stable one than we've had in Europe, the smart approach is you start with cap and trade because of all of the political economy advantages. You increase the degree of auctions over time, which is precisely what's been done in Europe. And then once that's established, then you can introduce a reserve price on the auctions and you get what Dallas was referring to in the Californian system. Hey, presto, you've got a reasonably solid base of a carbon price. And in some ways it is more complicated, but outside of Scandinavia and the unusual circumstances of British Columbia, after 25 years, I've concluded that's probably the best way to go to try and get a single carbon price. Okay, enough of that, because my main point is, I think that is fine but not sufficient. I think to make further progress, we need to actually broaden our economic horizons on this issue somewhat. And in part of that, find ways of clarifying better what carbon pricing can deliver for those who are being asked to pay, because that's the nub of the political economy issue. And I think it's important context to stress that this is also about paying for a problem which spans from the frankly rather inattentive decisions of 7 billion energy consumers on the planet right through to long-term transformation of some of the most complex socio-technical systems we've had. Empirically, actually, most of the gains that I referred to in my opening remarks have not been driven by carbon pricing. They've been driven by energy efficiency, by renewables policies, by lots of stuff. So what's going on here? Well, the way that I tend to think about it is we have a world of economics which has an idealized representative agent assumption in it That leads to the conception of a best practice frontier, the technology frontier, the possibilities frontier, whatever you want to call it. I think possibilities frontier is a really bad word because that is one thing it absolutely does not describe. But it's the frontier and it describes, you know, vertically the trade-off between resource use and economic output. Fine. What you actually discover when you look more closely, and that obviously is what the basic assumption around a lot of neoclassical economics is, most agents in most real economies are somewhere to the left of that line. They are not even at Pareto optimization. There are lots of reasons. A lot of those reasons are articulated in the behavioral and organizational economics and management theory and transaction cost theory, lots and lots of other reasons why a lot of agents are way short of that line. We have diverse individual organizational decision making, huge literature on energy efficiency potentials, et cetera, et cetera. Doesn't mean you can magically move everyone to the frontier, but there are really interesting and surprisingly large potentials, and a substantial part of policy has been getting at those potentials. Now, in the book that I published last year on this topic, I introduced a shorthand name, stole it from the economics literature 50 years back about satisficing. And that's a kind of the first area, because that's sort of the real behavioral starting point. The second area of the idealized optimizing agents is thereby a kind of second domain of economic theory. But of course, the reason you don't call that thing a possible, shouldn't ever call that a possibilities frontier, is because technology evolves, it moves. And it can move in very different directions and different ways and at different paces. For this problem, what you don't really want is innovation to move up and to the right, i.e. more emissions-intensive technology over time. And this was well covered in Professor Aguillon's comment about dirty versus clean innovation. It is absolutely central. What you want is either, well, you put on a strong carbon price and you push that arrow way down, but probably at a significant economic cost, or you try and find a toolbox to accelerate innovation but in a low-carbon direction. That, broadly, is a domain where you're talking about evolutionary economics, institutional economics, systems innovation theories, and so forth. And again, the shorthand is that's the domain you look to for trying to transform systems. So you've got three broad domains of economic behavior and underpinning theory. And the one thing I would stress is absolutely not saying one of these is better or more important than another. They describe different processes that happen at different social scales. You're starting with broadly individual psychology and internal organizational structure through to market scales, through to broad national and international scales generally involved in transformative change, and time scales likewise. The individual consumer looking 1-2 years ahead, most markets looking maybe 10, maybe 20 if you're lucky. Systems transformation is measured in decades through to the, indeed, typically 5 to 10 decades for major transformations of the global energy system. So there are actually three quite complementary sets of theories that describe different processes going with different kinds of actors over different social and time scales. What does that imply for policy? Well, clearly where you are dealing with the optimizing domain here, there, markets do what they should do. They allocate resources, and if you got prices right, they will do so efficiently. So markets and pricing are the instrument of highest relevance where you are dealing with optimizing agents in a market, or optimizing agents and resource allocation. Fine, so that's what the H is, highest relevance. It will have some knock-on effects on these other economic domains. The broad aim is incentivize through price people to go out and buy cleaner products and processes and industries to make them. If your predominant problem is around satisficing barriers, behavioral characteristics, the energy efficiency gap, all of that stuff, a lot of the big gains have been delivered by energy efficiency standards or enabling and engagement strategies. You look at any of the literature on vehicles efficiency standards, fridge standards, and so forth. And building standards above all. That's the most effective instrument where you are dealing with satisficing behavior. And there's various reasons, in part because you can actually remove a lot of transaction and search costs as well. In principle, therefore, you're driving smarter choices. However, if you're trying to transform a system overall, you have to get into the realm of strategic investment, which you can easily define as an investment that delivers a positive strategic return that cannot be fully captured by any individual entity in a market. And there's lots of them. We are replete with them. Most of them we call education or infrastructure, but a lot of innovation in this space as well requires that kind of strategic investment. And the best shorthand then is that's delivering innovation and infrastructure, structural change in the economies and technologies that serve us. So I'm going to just dig a little bit deeper into this third pillar. I don't have time really to cover issues on the other two, but I do then want to touch on relationship with carbon pricing. Because first, just to stress, when I use the word innovation or strategic investment, I'm not just referring to research and development. That is a complete caricature of the problem. Innovation is a very complex process that occurs over many stages, nor is it something purely driven by markets. In fact, the reason innovation is so complex is precisely because it's a hybrid of the above two and everything in between. But the way that, in a sense, I try to get a handle on this is with the following slide. And it underlines, in my view, what is different about this issue. The data on the right is the research and development intensity of different sectors. You look at IT, you look at pharmaceuticals, the sectors that we think of as being vibrant, innovative, really good for our economies, they spend 10 to 15% of their turnover on research and development, the private sector. Unfortunately, what we're after is radical transformative change in innovation in the sectors that are right in the bottom group there. You see three groups, top group, you know, the top two anyway, 10 to 15% of turnover on research development, energy, construction, gas, electricity, 0.5% or less. So we're trying to transform sectors that spend about 1/20th of as much on R&D as do the sectors we think of as the bright lights of innovation. Until you've understood why, then just throwing a carbon price at the problem is unlikely to change that. Right? So I don't have time to go into it, but it's to do broadly with the connectivity, and this is a point I think that Philip Aguillon made actually quite centrally, though he might have spelled it out. Part of the problem here is you've got big, complex, expensive technology development, and then you have no product differentiation. You have no markup. You can't go out and sell a low-carbon electron at 5 times the price of a high-carbon electron. You are competing against incumbent industries with exactly the same product, low margins, high risks, results, very little innovative activity intrinsically in the sector. And it's one reason why I have a long-standing dispute about the way some of the sort of empirically grounded innovation is fed into models without saying, well, actually, can't we get better than 0.5%? And the answer is yes, if you take the right kind of policy measures. Some core points about this area, and then I'll start moving to the link with carbon pricing and wrap up. Some core points about what I'd call third domain economics, just to stress that it's not purely innovation, it's the interaction of innovation, R&D, the learning by doing, the scale economies, the supply chains, the infrastructure, the institutions, all the stuff that is mapped in evolutionary economics and theories of structural change. First is neither the pace nor the direction of energy innovation is optimal, least of all in the presence of public bad. Accelerating innovation in such sectors can therefore potentially generate an economic surplus, which can be shared between private and public goods. It is not synonymous with research and development. It has to span the full innovation chain, and the economic gains emerge as businesses get closer to the market and as the supply chains mature. The deployment phase also starts to forestall high carbon lock-in. And let's be clear, lock-in is neither a good or a bad thing. It's simply a statement about the nature of economies. The question is, are you fostering good lock-in or bad lock-in in your overall strategy? Which again, a point that Aguillon picked up. Carbon leakage we all talk about. Well, what about the positive side of it? Improve technologies, change, diffuse globally, and reduce emissions elsewhere. We don't know very much empirically about the balance between those two forces, but over time, the latter would tend to dominate, which also then amplifies the economic gains to the earlier emergent industries, innovations, supply chains. So those are sort of some core points about the relevance of third domain economics in this kind of problem. Link with carbon pricing. Far from sufficiently mapped, but let me just kind of state it obvious. If you take that kind of broken innovation chain that I flagged, you can simplify it by saying, well, what's really missing? Why are these sectors so weak at innovation? And it's partly because the missing money problem due to the structural gaps in the chain, so you need much more money. In Europe, we had a low-carbon steel program with the industry. The industry spent about 30 million, said there's some really interesting technologies here. To actually prove them, we need to go to $500 million, and we companies can't do that on our own. It takes money to get big and serious on industrial low-carbon technologies. The other thing is you have to get the markets deeper into the innovation chain, which is broadly what renewable energy policies have tried to do by saying you'll pick out technologies that you really think have to be part of the solution and give them a premium price to drive the market. Ideally, we'd like to get away from that kind of subsidy onto where those technologies thrive on the basis of a carbon price, driving the market. To do that, there has to be confidence, not just there will be a carbon price, but confidence in its direction and evolution, which is where one loops back to the question about a floor price and the rising over time. We have actually gained quite a lot of experience around policies to help technologies span the innovation chain. I don't have time to go through it. It is not simple stuff, but to me it's essential to deal with this. I think the missing component, personally, is it's been in a field almost completely separated from the carbon pricing debate. That, I think, is our fundamental policy and analytic failure here. The two should never have been separated and fought out as alternatives. They should be part of the integrated package. I don't have time to sort of do a visual cost benefit, but leaves me, the gains can be very, very large and are, of course, the gains of a technology strategy amplified by rising carbon price. Finally, to come on to the international question, which has perplexed and bedeviled us much of this day, my view is becoming broadly, if we want carbon pricing agreed internationally, you have to bring technology into the equation. The international processes, as Scott and others have said, have tended to focus on targets and pricing. Innovation has an essential theoretical appeal in a global context, which is you can generate a surplus. But at least based on the empirical data that I've seen, there's every prospect you can generate an economic surplus with low-carbon innovation that can be shared and can potentially be shared broadly amongst club members if it's structured in the right way. The practical, I need hardly spell out the practical benefits if you get innovation right. But there's some pooling and some mutual benefits. Not everything will succeed. You cooperate on the learning, the lessons, you negotiate the IP, etc. We haven't actually been very good at technology in the international stage, and I think partly because it's been seen as being pushed by developing countries in terms of technology transfer, send us technology for free or subsidized, which makes industrialized countries very nervous both about intellectual property and the costs. And I understand that nervousness, but to my mind, the fact remains that this is a very promising way forward. I think I need to perhaps skip the sort of summary diagram from the book, which is about how all three pillars relate to each other and can help each other. And bear in mind that first pillar is basically about bringing entities closer to the frontier, which means that you are accelerating the gains to low carbon innovation through your policies on energy efficiency, low carbon assistance, etc. The final point that I wanted to flag, since so much of this day has indeed, and I think very understandably, been about carbon price, is my conclusion: carbon price is not the standard tool. In the real world, it never has been. And actually, in my view, that is theoretically too simplified. But properly designed, you could make a case that amongst these three pillars, perhaps we can find a way of making it a kind of first among equals. Particularly if I have a rising base carbon reduction value, let me generalize the concept to allow some of the other variants around. It's not only doing the obvious thing in markets, first of all, helping to forestall carbon lock-in from coal power, it is also potentially a signal to everybody, including consumers, you know, this carbon problem, it's real. We've got a structure in place. This stuff is going to get more expensive over time. Pay attention, get more efficient, etc. So it's an instrument that also reinforces the engagement standards efficiency side of the business. And of course, it increases investment stability for industries on the third leg, third pillar. I think we should be talking about earmarking funding from carbon revenues. I think there's a very good economic and a cast iron political economy case. Coming back to my very opening remark, you try and say to people, we want to take your money with a carbon price, but we're not going to tell you what we use it for, is really bad politics. To explain what it can be used for is far better politics. And finally, that it can feed into international technology cooperation, potentially with some other dimensions that ultimately, I think, mean you can create a club-based approach to solving this problem, but without having to reach for border measures. Because I do see no willingness in the diplomatic community to cross that bridge, but I think the concept that you can generate a club good without reaching for border measures is far more compelling and enticing to the diplomatic community. And I shall finish there. Thank you.